Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Well, thank you, Nicholas. Greetings. How to do?
And, of course, Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Nicholas. I'm good.
Excellent. Well, let us not dilly-dally. It is a Thursday, and so it is the last show of the week for the Daily Friend Show. And let us get straight into the great and weighty topics that bedevil the country. Now, anyone who's been listening to us for a while will know that we talk a lot about the election postponement court battle, in which the IRR is a, the correct legal term is amicus. Is that right, Gabriel?
Amicus curiae, friend of the court.
Right.
It's funny because amicus sounds like amicable, and amicable is a word for friendly.
Exactly. It's that good old Latin.
It's funny how it works. The English is very clever.
Like Amity Island and Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. There's a reference from before my time. Yeah, no idea what that is.
You uneducated youth. Jaws, man. Stephen's. Oh, no, come on. Big Shark.
Ah! Unfortunately, Terence, I don't think we have time for you to culturally uplift us here. But anyway, so, you know, we think that this court battle about whether the election is going to be postponed is really, in a lot of ways, a battle for the future of South Africa's democracy. And we mean that in a very real way because of the implications it has for the government's ability to mess with elections and the court's powers over our elections, as well as the integrity of our constitution. So Gabriel suggested that we perhaps do a little bit of an update on the situation because he, of course, is been following the case very closely and is talking to our lawyers and watching what else is going on. So, Gabriel, where are we in the legal battle and the surrounding issues? So there's been a lot of headlines recently about
the amazing headline from the ANC is we're going to court, to the electoral court, to say that, no, this is rubbish, because we can't register all our candidates. And they made the same argument before the Constitutional Court. They said, we're a very good party and we like sticking to the rules and we do stick to the rules. So the first three premises, okay, but fourth premise, because of coronavirus, we can't stick to the rules. And so please, can you break the rules so that we can stick to them? And that's about as reasonable as it gets. The amazing thing is then the ANC says the next day, no, we're not going to court. We're actually withdrawing our papers. We'll wait to see what the Constitutional Court says. And that comes in the midst of mounting incredibility, particularly mounting evidence of the incapacity of the ANC to run a bath, as we finished our last podcast. So they owe roughly 200 million rand, some of it's to SARS, some of it's to pension schemes, some of it's to Ipsos Independent Pollster. They also owe lots of money to their own staff. How much money they owe to their staff is not something that I think we have a number on, but it's clearly pretty bad. The last thing the party wants to do right now is not pay its staff, hasn't been able to do so properly for a couple of months. And that's not a complete surprise. The warnings of the ANC being unable to pay its staff have been coming for a long time. In fact, someone shared to friends of the Institute a piece by Gareth van Onselen, who used to work with the Institute of Race Relations, from many years ago, at least 5 years ago, saying, will the ANC go bankrupt before it gets driven out of power? Now, why this all matters is, I think, twofold. Firstly, because in the context of the Constitutional Court ruling, there's more pressure on the court politically to find that it has the superpower to break the Constitution. Because if it doesn't do that, the ANC goes into an election with 90 wards not properly represented by the ANC, with either proportional representation or ward councillors not on the ballot. And most of those are in the districts of KZN that that Nkandla's in, the district just north of where Nkandla is that runs all the way to Eswatini, and the next one that sort of runs up Richards Bay, KwaDuduzu, big sort of coastal areas. So the ANC's problem politically in terms of the riots and Zuma's jailing is that the closer we are to the riots, the harder it is in any event for it to get its act together in KZN, because so many prominent KZN politicians have said, no, we don't like the ANC. It's run by the puppet of white monopoly capital called Ramaphosa. It's into this Western ideology of the rule of law and deadline, all this kind of thing. We can't do that. You guys must go away. You must let Getlei Hlekisa come back out and run South Africa in a traditional fashion. They can't quickly turn around and then say, no, vote for your ANC ward councillor in the local election. It also makes it difficult for the contest to take place. Who gets to be on the list? It's always been a violent thing with the ANC. Four people have been killed. Four ANC councillors have been killed this year. That's quite low compared to 2016. It was like 40 in the build-up to the last local municipal elections. We've got a little bit more time for that to play out. The point is, it's always difficult for the ANC. Right now, it's impossible for the ANC to get a good showing in KZN. It's literally not on the list. It doesn't have the political capacity to get its campaign machine going in terms of local leaders that are loyal to the party but also loyal to Zuma, and it literally can't get a campaign going. 2016 has spent R1 billion. This time, it's not clear that it can even pay back its debts, right? So in terms of the free T-shirts and stuff that it needs to get people to vote for it, that's a challenge too. This all means that this election feels different to all the other elections we've had. My last point is just going to be, if you look at the overall trend, on the back of increasing corruption, decreasing service delivery, plateauing and then falling standards of living, increasing unemployment, we've seen ANC performance in municipal elections go down from 66% to 63.8% in 2011. That drops to 55.6% in 2016. So that's a 7-8% drop in that election cycle. If you had the same kind of drop as we had from 2011, 2016 to 2016, 2021, then the ANC would come down to 48%. So that's just on the back of the normal trends of disillusionment with a party that's unable to pass clean financial audits, fill potholes, get the water tap to open and water comes out. Okay. If you add to that those problems that I've just described, then an inability to get a campaign machine going, an inability to pay staff, basically bankruptcy in the ANC. I very serious, and losing control of a lot of patronage adds to the desperation of the ANC. And this all adds to an ANC that's so poor that it gets poorer because it loses more of its tentacles in government. And I think that's kind of good news, because something like that has to happen through the democratic process. It's also kind of scary, because what happens when you corner a crocodile?
Yes, I think that's exactly the right analogy to draw in this case. Terence, your thoughts on this issue? I mean, I must say it was quite – I almost didn't believe it when I saw the sort of news headline saying, you know, ANC candidates in – can't remember, I think it was 30 municipalities or something like that, not able to
– 90.
Weren't reg- 90. We're not registered.
On the ANC's court papers, 90.
We're not registered in time for the election process, and they can take this to court, because what were some of the things they said in their court papers? Our staff were emotionally drained and overworked from not having been paid for 3 months. As I said previously, I missed the part where that became our problem. Seems distinctly like an ANC problem.
You know, I think that if some mean old corporate with headquarters in Sandton was making its staff work for 3 months with no pay, the ANC would be distinctly unsympathetic to any pleas that, their share price is falling because the people are drained and overworked because they haven't been paid. I think failure to pay, failure to earn an income generally does manifest itself in things like being drained and, you know, not feeling so great. Is it our problem? Not technically, but, you know, I would say that there is a political angle to this. Because if we go into an election where the ANC stands to take a battering, even lose municipalities that it may once have held, or you know, has a decent chance of retaining, we could be stuck with the next couple of years with a vengeful ANC, you know, decrying this as illegitimate, and. While perhaps the upper reaches of Luthuli House might be able to accept that this ultimately was on them, I'm not sure that your local level structures are going to feel quite the same way, and are going to be humble in defeat. They certainly weren't always magnanimous in victory. And when you know, as Gabriel says, you take away the means to sustain those patronage networks, and this is a particular problem at municipal level. That's one of the reasons why most of our municipalities are in distress, and many of them are completely dysfunctional. A wounded tiger, yeah, I think that's a decent analogy. But what concerns me is the throwing up of questioning of the integrity of the election, not because there is any substantive evidence of malfeasance or rigging or tampering or whatever, but simply because it didn't suit us. It is interesting that we've seen this a couple of times on the part of commentators that people who are not ignorant and often quite thoughtful people who have conflated the electoral issues we have with the health of the ANC. Remember, it was one chap who wrote and said that wrote to the Business Day and said that a constituency system isn't going to solve the problem because the ANC's problems are deeper. Well, that's not the point. Constituency representation, has its own merits and its own challenges, irrespective of whether you have a functional or dysfunctional party. But here you have a highly, highly educated man with a doctorate who I think teaches at a British university now. You couldn't quite seem to break these two apart. That the issue has to be getting the ANC right, and then we can kind of talk about the election subsequently. Having constituencies, by the way, is not going to be a cure-all solution. He's right as far as it goes.
So, on that point of the integrity of the elections may be called into question.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point, especially because that creates, there's this podcast I listen to, they always use this phrase, permission structure, to basically behave badly when it comes to elections in the future, because the ANC will be able to tell its members then, it's okay if we bend the rules on elections and we cheat and we do that kind of thing because the system was biased against us anyway. And you can see that by the fact that we were treated so unfairly by the last election. And I think that is the greatest concern that could come from the fact that the ANC is not able to get all of its candidates into the system. Gabriel,
although hold on to your hats, right? So if you go back through, I think any of the major elections, yeah, Ghana, Egypt, Tanzania, those are the first three that popped to mind in Africa in the last year. Certainly, if you go back further, you can add to the list. There have been a lot of contestations of the validity of elections, and the most famous example is in the U.S. There is something kind of gross about the big lie kind of story, and I think that this is the kind of thing that political parties do either way. So my caution is don't back away, don't postpone the election, don't think that that's going to save you the problem. If you just postpone, start de novo, the ANC will be able to reopen its candidate listing, it won't have this problem with the 90 that it's not on, then we can go forward, then it'll never complain. If the ANC drops before 48%, below 50%, I'm sure it'll complain on another basis. And here's why I do not take it on good faith, because it's not acting in good faith. The ANC's court papers say to the Constitutional Court that we cannot have a free and fair election because the ANC's process cannot be followed because we need a quorum of 50 plus one people, and we could never have that during level three or level four. Then on the day that they withdraw their application from the Constitutional Court and on the day after the deadline for signing up the candidate lists, you have an ANC NEC member and member of the cabinet saying, no, 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 we had it completely free and fair. We did it exactly the way we needed to do it. It was very difficult, and we had all these problems, and we wish we could have done it better, but we did do it correctly well. We had quorums. Our branch system worked. This is a contradiction. Either the ANC lied to the people or the ANC lied to the court. This is not a new thing. Of course, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma said on the day of the proclamation that the reason she needs to do it is so the IEC can go to court. That was never true. We called that out as untrue immediately because we know a little bit about the law, even though we're laymen. It turns out she also knew it was untrue, as shown by a letter exposed to the court that she'd signed the day before. So Dlamini-Zuma has lied to the court or to the people. The ANC have lied to the court or to the people about this election. When the party's being that brazen as to lie to the people in big press briefings, carry it around, and then say the opposite thing to the court, then you can't presume that it's acting in good faith. And if you add to that the pattern of assassination, the direct connection to the patronage network, the sort of woeful status of its branch system, which, by the way, I mean, it spent R1 billion on the election campaign in 2016 for national municipal elections. Mm-hmm. It then spent R1 billion in 2017 to get 5,000 superdelegates to vote either for Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma or Ramaphosa. Tell me that's not corrupt. At least R70 million of that was spent on updating ANC members' annual membership fee of R20. How many times is R20 going to R70 million? It's brazen. It's a brazen top-down pay-for-play system. And I think that assuming that if you postpone, then it won't question the credibility of the elections would be a mistake. I think it's a dangerous thing that Terence points out. Absolutely correct. We must guard ourselves for it. But I think it's coming one way or another when the ANC loses.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But I will say that, the one of the things that I think marks a lot of these African countries that you mentioned there is that the claims to fraud really don't have a lot of validity. And regardless, they still cause a lot of problems with the electoral system. Anyway,
The winners never claim fraud, hey?
Yes, that's true. Lunga in Zambia, despite being in charge and despite arguably having cheated, and despite running the Electoral Commission, still claimed fraud when he lost in Zambia recently. Although he was forced to basically withdraw that after sort of 24 hours because it was so completely ridiculous. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. And that is, of course, South Africa is, I think, trying to stay in the lead. In international affairs, we're trying to get some more news coverage back to ourselves, and we seem to have done that by mutating ourselves another variant of COVID. Gabriel, you've been our main sort of dude looking into how things are going with COVID and what the science says, that kind of stuff. What do you make of this new variant thing? Is it actually going to affect anything in particular, or should we not pay that much attention to it? What do you think?
It's quite interesting. I think everyone's welcome to pay attention. It's an interesting preprint, unreviewed scientific article that came out, and really no one cared until it got tweeted about. C.1.2 is not a variant of concern. It is not a variant of interest. Those are strictly defined terms, and it's neither. It is not... it's not Delta, it's not Beta, it's not the South African variant. Even calling it a variant is a little bit of a funny thing. Just remember the way mutations work. There's a thing called drift, which is a little bit like when you copy-paste a book, or especially in the old-fashioned way, sort of rewrite the Bible by hand before the printing press, which is that someone misspells the word. But if you spell the with two T's, most people can still read it. If you spell apple with one P, most people can still read it. So that's a non-semantically different change, right? It means something in the genome has changed, but it doesn't make a meaningful difference. There is constantly non-meaningful changes taking place in the evolutionary process, including with SARS-CoV-2. The real thing is when there's a meaningful change. There's no test to show that the changes that have taken place in C.1.2 are meaningful changes. There's no laboratory test. There's no in-person statistical evidence to that effect. So basically what they're seeing is that this thing has the most mutations that seem like they might be meaningful of anything on record, which is not a surprise. South Africa has, the best evidence suggests, spread coronavirus faster than anywhere else on the planet through the hardest, longest, and most irrational lockdown. So we're amazing. Okay, but is this a particularly dangerous variant of concern? There's no evidence to say yes. All of the mutations that it has in its cardinal epitope are that are scary are mutations that already exist in Delta and Beta, or at least in Delta and or Beta. Does that mean it's nothing? No, it might be something, but we're going to have to figure that out. Right now, it's like a premature idea. I'm trying to avoid saying something with a double entendre. It's too soon to be jumping to conclusions, is what I'm going to just limit myself to saying. Excepting for this, you know, it is deliciously good timing. The Constitutional Court is deliberating this thing. It's worried. It's been told. All the scientific experts have said September, October are likely to be the best time to have an election, because, excepting for the government's doctors, but all the independent ones said this is the best time to do it because we're in a trough between waves, and the thing that will trigger the next wave is likely to be a new variant. And just in the middle of deliberations, there's this talk of this new variant of concern that's all over the news all of the time without any evidence that it's a variant of concern. It's technically definitely not a variant of concern, because for it to be that, it would have to have passed tick boxes that it hasn't. So I'm a bit irritated at the timing. I'm not saying that that's the scientists' fault. I think they did exactly what they should have done, which is release the information as soon as they have it, have other people look into it. Last thing, Professor Francois Belou, who's kind of a guy to good to follow on Twitter. He's at the University of London, London College. Anyway, he's an expert in this field, and he pointed out that on the Oxford data, C.1.2 might actually have gone extinct, because it was first appeared in May, went up to like a couple of hundred people, and then went back down. So that's another reason to be unclear about whether it is a real anything. That picture and tweet that he then picked up was used by the Daily Mail, which is a notoriously pop UK publication. And he was like, I wish they'd asked my permission, but he didn't deny at all that what they had done was accurately represent his views, that the world's leading variant of concern might actually be extinct, for all we know.
Okay, well, that's good news. Obviously, you know, these things change, and we will have to keep an eye on it. Terence, anything to add on that? You know, this is a theme we have talked about before, about how bad a lot of reporting is on COVID. Just to sort of clear that journalists don't always fully grasp the implications of what they're saying.
Well, I must say it's an honor to work with someone like Gabriel who understands this. So I suppose my comment here is headlined by what Gabriel said. Beyond that, I think there's a sort of twin set of dangers, the overreaction and the underreaction. The determination not to see a problem, give me COVID or give me death, in which case, you know, the latter option might sometimes intrude, and then it's not so much fun. or the idea that, you know, we've got to sort of lock ourselves in hermetically sealed nuclear bunkers, you know, until one day the pandemic runs out of steam. You know, this position is often taken then by people who will simultaneously say this is the new normal. Well, you know, exactly how this will play out in our institutions and our culture, I think that remains to be seen. But invoking COVID to kind of avoid going on with life, because life ultimately has to go on, is not, I think, a viable thing for a society to do. You know, we had that hard lockdown whose goal was to get us ready for, you know, for when the apocalypse struck. A lot of that effort was wasted, and, you know, the lockdown kind of became a goal in itself and a signifier of, you know, whether you were a good person or, you know, some sort of bastard who, you know, wanted everyone to die. You know, it is what it is. Let us follow what the science says about it in as non-disruptive a way as we can.
Right, no, exactly. Okay, let us move on to our final story of today. And I just want to first give a recommendation to anyone who's really interested in our thoughts perhaps on the war in Afghanistan or the topic in general. Gabriel and I did a very long podcast on that, which we quite enjoyed. Hopefully you will too. That's our Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree podcast. You can check that out. I think it should also be up on the Daily Friend a little bit later today.
To give a sense of how good that podcast is, it's like an hour and a half and I almost say nothing. Nicholas's knowledge on the Afghan situation, history, contemporary, past, it's amazing. It's really a delight. I was very happy to listen to him. I think you would be too, so go check it out.
Oh, thank you for that. Although I did make a mistake.
That's high praise, folks. That's high praise.
I did make a mistake in that I didn't differentiate between the two coups in the 70s, but that's not particularly important right now. Anyway.
Shame on you, Nicholas. Shame on you.
The story that I'm trying to bring up here that's kind of connected to Afghanistan, so you can listen to that, is regarding South Africa. And of course, hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing Afghanistan right now because they do not want to live under the regime of the Taliban. Taliban, despite their assurances to the contrary, appear to be enacting revenge killings and oppression pretty much across the whole country. And with regards to refugees fleeing Afghanistan, the South African government has announced that it cannot possibly take any Afghan refugees. A statement released by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation said the country was not in a position to accommodate any Afghan refugees, saying essentially, we already have a whole bunch of refugees here who are benefiting from social assistance and free medical health care. We can't possibly take on any more. In the quote from the statement is, the South African government notes the overtures made to the country to consider receiving a number of Afghanistan refugees who have sought refuge in Pakistan. The South African government is unfortunately not in a position to accommodate such a request. In terms of international law, the well-being of refugees is best served by remaining in the first country of arrival. Terence, what do you make of this?
Well, in many minds, you know, on the one hand, I suppose the South African government could turn around and say, you know, they were against the whole Afghanistan war from the beginning. It's not their problem. You know, those who ignored their counsel should bear the burden of this. And interestingly, you know, South Africa accepts a lot, de facto, a lot of refugees, but it's not like these people generally come as refugees and are then kind of assisted by the government. It's essentially, the border is very porous. People stream in looking for work. Sometimes, you know, that is pushed by the political conditions in their home countries. You know, you see just stories of people who've like literally walked from the DRC, Zimbabwe. We don't even know really what the size of those populations are. I'm not 100% sure just how efficiently or, you know, to what extent we accept actual refugees, people who are, you know, who fear persecution in their home countries and want to come to South Africa explicitly as a refuge. I would imagine it's a fairly small number and the government and our government is probably not overly, not overly given to recognizing that, because that comes with a whole lot of you know, diplomatic complications. I don't think that it would be all that sympathetic to Afghan refugees, because that would in a sense be validating the concerns of American foreign policy. And the ANC has, I think, set itself up very much as an opponent of America. we've had instances, you know, where there've been a few high profile people from Zimbabwe, for instance, coming and looking for asylum. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure how those situations ever got resolved. You know, if you grant that sort of protection from another state, particularly a state with which you have some sort of friendly relations, you are implicitly saying that, yeah, you know, you guys are getting up to all sorts of mischief. But if you just kind of like, you know, let lots and lots of people in, you can sort of shrug and say, well, you know, bad economic conditions or, you know, we don't really know how many are here. But yeah, you know, I think this is a situation, that would be complicated for our government. And it's simply decided, and one can certainly argue the morality of this, as washing its hands, going to be Alexandrian, and it's just not going to touch it. I think one of the interesting questions, are there any South Africans left in Afghanistan? I heard that there were a couple, and we weren't doing very much to get any of them out.
Well, that's not terribly surprising. Gabriel, in 30 seconds or so, your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think Terence's last point is the most urgent. If there are citizens, then we should have done something, and I'm not sure we have, and I don't think we can. If there are refugees, if you can't run your own party, if you can't run a bath, if you can't make the electricity run on time, let alone the trains run at all, can you run a refugee camp? I'm not sure. Maybe the Afghans are much luckier with us saying no and them going to Poland instead.
Right. I'm sure the Poles are going to be all that wild about taking them either.
Germany.
The Germany is probably more likely. The Poles are not too keen on refugees. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So we thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week, Monday. And we hope you have a lovely weekend. Please support the IRR. Please support the Daily Friend. And also check out the podcast Gabriel and I did, Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. Anyway, thanks everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.